My collier. What was I doing paying attention to a stranger at a time like this? Then the man nodded his head towards me, lifted his hat briefly, and walked away. That's how it started.
In part one of Restless by William Boyd, dramatised by Melissa Murray, Sally was played by Eileen Atkins, Ruth, Fenella Woolgar, Hamid, Akbar Kurta, Jochen, Gene Goodman, and Veronica, Lizzie Watts. It was directed by Mark Beebe. Well, tomorrow, while Ruth learns more about her mother's former life, her own past begins to catch up with her. That's part two of Restless, tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.
This is the news from the BBC. We transmit round the world and locally.
BBC Radio Young Writers, 25 years on.
I've got it!
He gets it.
Who's going to love you? Someone.
The first radio plays from writers who've gone on to make their mark in theatre, television and film.
What have you done to say you's a man?
Yeah, tell me what I should do, Dad.
Including performances from Alan Cumming, Steve Coogan, Mary Wimbush and Ian Dury.
There had been so many happy endings in the early days that they'd been difficult to handle.
Beginning with Benjamin Zephaniah's Hurricane Dub, Saturday afternoon at 1:15 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we begin Matthew Hollis's biography of the momentous final years of the writer and critic Edward Thomas and his extraordinary journey towards becoming a poet, a journey that was to coincide with the outbreak of the First World War. Tobias Menzies reads, Now All Roads Lead to France.
Edward Thomas spent the day before he died under particularly heavy bombardment. The shell that fell 2 yards from where he stood should have killed him, but instead, it was a rare dud. Back at billet, the men teased him on his lucky escape. Someone remarked that a fellow with Thomas's luck should be safe wherever he went. Next morning was the first of the Arras offensive. The Allied assault was so immense that some Germans were captured half-dressed. Others did not have time to put on their boots and fled barefoot through the mud and snow. British troops sang and danced in what only a few hours before had been no man's land. Edward Thomas left the dugout and leaned into the opening to take a moment to fill his pipe. A shell passed so close to him that the blast of air stopped his heart. He fell without a mark on his body. At the cramped premises off Theobald's Road in Bloomsbury on the 8th of January 1913, the Poetry Bookshop officially opened its doors. Poets, journalists, critics, readers, patrons. That afternoon and the one that followed, 300 people crammed into the little shop. Wilfred Gibson, the most popular young poet of the decade, was already resident in the attic and had only to walk downstairs, while the wooden-legged, self-declared supertramp W.H. Davies had hobbled in all the way from Kent. F.S. Flint, a dynamic young civil servant and poet, took a place on the busy staircase and told the stranger beside him that he could tell by his shoes that he was an American. The shoes belonged to Robert Frost, newly arrived in London. Aged 38, Frost was a literary unknown without a book to his name, and he had come to England to see that changed. In the time ahead, almost every poet worth their salt would become part of the story of the Poetry Bookshop. T.S. Eliot would be a caller, Wilfred Owen a tenant in the attic rooms. Robert Graves, Charlotte Mew, Francis Cornford, Richard Aldington and Eleanor Fargen would have books published under the shop's imprint. For the next 2 decades, the bookshop would be exactly what Rupert Brooke pronounced it to be when it opened, the centre of the new poetry. Also present at the bookshop off Theobald's Road that day was someone who would influence the reputation of almost every writer present, a and would become, in Frost's words, the only brother I ever had. Edward Thomas. Thomas had travelled to the poetry bookshop from his parents' house in Balham, London. His family home lay at Steep in Hampshire, and he had come away to escape it. His spirits were desperately low. 34 years of age, a married father of three, Thomas was, in his mind, little more than a literary hack, writing all the hours that he could manage to bring home a modest income. In poor spirits, he treated his family cruelly, scolding the children and reprimanding his wife, and the more he did so, the worse his spirits became. The only way he knew to break the cycle was to leave. Sometimes his absences lasted days, at other times he could be gone for months, leaving the children in the care of Helen, the woman he had married 13 years earlier and who loved him with a passion that he could no longer return. By all accounts, Edward Thomas was a striking man. At 6 foot, he was tall for the times, slim, loose-limbed, and vigorous. His expression was grave and detached, but his smile, when it came, could be coy, whimsical, or proud. He rarely laughed. A short clay pipe was never far from his lips or the palm of his left hand. He had a countryman's stride, and he dressed in a suit of tawny tweed, which was old, sunned, and slightly loose, and which, he liked to say, smelt of dog whenever it was damp. As a professional reviewer of verse, Thomas's brilliant, uncompromising articles were the making of many young reputations and the breaking of others. Thomas despised the substandard wherever he encountered it, in the anointed, in his peers, but most especially he despised it in himself. For when he was not sharpening his mind on reviewing, he was blunting it again through the commissions that were beneath his talents, endless and often aimless prose measured out by the page to fulfil his contractual obligations, civic guides, lumbering biographies, histories of castles. These were just some of the efforts that he put his name to, work that left him empty and exhausted and bitter at the abuse of his powers. Thomas had been plagued by depression from before his university days at Oxford. Towards his wife Helen, he was cruel at these times. Hard silences, harsh words, quiet fury, despair. She learned not to pursue him into his agony, but to leave him be and continue with her daily chores. In 1907, Thomas had written, "It is dislike of the effort to kill myself, and fear that I could not carry it through if I half did it, that keeps me alive. Only that. For I hate my work, my reviewing. My best, I feel, is negligible. I have no vitality, no originality, no love. I do harm. Love is dead, and lust is almost dead." In the winter of 1908, he made an attempt on his life that he documented in a short story. He had turned on his young daughter Bronwyn because she dared disturb his melancholy, and now she was wailing, and her cries struck him to the core. He went to the drawer where he kept an old revolver, rebuked Helen when she tried desperately to distract him, crossed the wheat fields in front of the house, and began to climb Shoulder of Mutton Hill. He wished for a place to hide, away from family and self-disgust, somewhere far enough off that the sound of a gunshot would not travel home, and finally he found it, surrounded by beech trees. He raised the gun quickly to his chest. His finger fluttered on the trigger, too lightly to fire. He imagined that he had succeeded, opened his eyes. Shaking with cold, he turned for home. "Shall I make the tea?" said Helen as he took off his boots. "Please," is what he said. Helen Noble first laid eyes on Edward Thomas in the summer of 1894, when the 16-year-old youth began calling on her father at their home near Wandsworth Common. A year older than Edward, Helen was a confident, even forward girl. But when Mr. Noble died in 1896, Helen's mother forbade her any sight of Edward. Helen left home for a post as a nursery governess in Broadstairs, Kent, from where she wrote long, affectionate letters to Edward. By the time he went up to Lincoln College, Oxford, in the autumn of 1897, they had become lovers. Helen fell pregnant while Edward was still an undergraduate, and their relationship underwent a sea change. It became one of temperance, described by Thomas as a happiness so mild and cool that it resembled a saintliness. They married secretly in June 1899. Mrs. Noble's discovery of their secret brought about the final estrangement between mother and daughter. Mervyn Thomas was born while Edward was still at university. The prospect of having to earn a living for his new family put a strain on the young man which he would never fully overcome. Helen and Edward's first home together was a squalid South London terrace. It lasted them only 4 months. Edward turned against city living and found them a functional red brick cottage a mile from Bearsted in Kent. From here, Edward earned what he could from his pen. One morning, Helen returned from the post office to report that no letters offering work had arrived for him that day. "Why tell me what is written on your pale, wretched face?" he lashed out at her. "I am cursed, and you are cursed because of me." Pregnant for a second time, Helen wrote distressingly to her friend, Janet Hooton. "No one wants the wee thing. You ask why? Because we are very poor. Because it means more anxiety for Edward and more work for him. Home will become unendurable to him. He is selling some of his dearest books to pay for baby clothes and doctors, etc. And as he packs them up, I know how he is rebelling at fate, how hard life seems to him, how he regrets it all. He cannot love, Janet. He cannot respond to my love. How can he, when all is so dark?" It was the commission of a book on Oxford that rescued them. That, and a legacy that had come to Helen. Bronwyn was born in 1902, and the family, now four strong, moved to a farmhouse in the Weald of Kent. By 1906, earning £250 a year, the poverty seemed to be behind them, but it had come at a price to their relationship. By the time Edward Thomas met Robert Frost, it was clear to the American that he was practically living alone. Robert and Eleanor Frost and their four children entered the Clyde estuary in September 1912 on board the SS Parisian. In Frost's pocket was $1,100 raised from the sale of the family's farmhouse and land in New Hampshire. It was enough to last them a year or two, but they had no home to which they could return, and the gamble simply had to pay off. Frost felt that he had made little of his life up until then. A failed poultry farmer and a poet who had been all but ignored by American editors, he chose now to be as far away as possible from his prying relatives. They found a home in Beaconsfield, northwest of London, and he made the commitment to his poetry that he had long put off. "I am going to be justified of my poetry before the end," he commented. "I have hung off long enough. I wasn't going to pass 40 without having it out with myself on this score." That same year, Edward Thomas met Godwin Baynes, a pioneer of an early form of psychoanalysis in England. "The doctor is working magic with my disordered intellect," Thomas reported. Thomas's doctors had diagnosed him with neurasthenia, a term largely discredited today, but widely used then to describe any number of ill-defined conditions. To find self-reliance, to determine his own path, these were the drives that Thomas took from his sessions with Baynes. How was he to live without paining others? Should he live without dependence upon others, or should he hold out for the help of a rescuing hand? It was a question that was forming into the central and tumultuous struggle of his life. He wrote, I feel that my salvation depends upon a person, and that that person cannot be Helen, because she has come to resemble me too much. Early in 1913, it seemed to Thomas that the long-hoped-for saviour could be the gifted, kindly Godwin Baines. Such a person would indeed emerge to help him out of his despair that year. But he would not be a doctor.
And tomorrow, Edward Thomas finally meets Robert Frost in the second episode of Now All Roads Lead to France by Matthew Hollis. The reader was Tobias Menzies. It was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Emma Harding.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and time for drama. Kate and Merton need money, Millie needs love. How far will they go to get what they want? In our Henry James classic in a moment. Then Mel Gedroych meets Dylan, the three-banded armadillo. We'll discover that an armadillo is warm to the touch and that it walks like a dancer. Amazing what you can find out from a visit to Edinburgh Zoo. Meet Dylan on the 4 o'clock show. Now on 4 Extra, we begin a three-part adaptation of Henry James's The Wings of the Dove, dramatised by Linda Marshall Griffiths.
I wait. You keep me waiting. I hate this room. Shabby sofa. Yellow stain of those prints. My face in the mirror. I'll go. I can feel you upstairs knowing I'm waiting and still. Papa, I give you up. It's as if the street is in this room, and this room and the 100 more worse than this in the street. This is the failure of everything, isn't it, Papa? Honor, fortune. This hat is wrong. I'm altogether in black, even my eyes, black. I won't give up. If I am the last word of this broken sentence of a family, I will have some sort of meaning. I'm glad you're so much better, Papa.
I'm not better. It's why I sent for you, so you may see me as I am.
I always see you as you are, Papa. Beautiful as ever. You look lovely.
That hat's wrong.
I know.
The feather. It's overdone.
How long have you had these rooms?
You are handsome.
And that gives you pleasure?
Oh, one of my very few.
I'm willing to go with you, Papa. Things have happened and I've only waited for seeing you till I could be quite sure. I am sure. I'll go with you.
Go with me where?
Anywhere. Here.
I don't believe you've made your mind up to that.
I could live with you even if I don't understand how you get on.
I don't get on.
You're flourishing, Papa.
Oh, do you throw it up at me again that I've not done away with myself?
Well, you know Mama had less to leave than she feared. It makes about 200 a year for Mary and 2 for me, but I give 100 to her and the children.
You weak thing.
The other 100 would do something for you and me together.
And what would do the rest?
Can you yourself do nothing?
I don't see what has so suddenly wound you up.
Aunt Maud has made me a proposal. She says it is time we should understand each other.
I can quite imagine what she means.
Can you?
She means she'll do for you handsomely if you break off relations with me.
So here I am, Papa.
Do you really suppose me in a position to justify you throwing yourself upon me?
You live. You flourish. You bloom.
Oh, you've always hated me.
Her condition is that I shall have absolutely nothing to do with you. Not speak or write, you should simply cease to exist.
And her promises? I'm a poor old ruin of a dad.
But I'm not quite the old ruin not to get something.
Oh, I think her idea is I should get a great deal.
I put it to your conscience. It's an admirable opportunity. And moreover, one for which you've really to thank me.
I don't see what my conscience has got to do with it.
I'm not talking only about what you might do for me, but what you might do with me. Use me. I'm still good, well, for a lot of things. There's in fact a coach and four to be got out of me. You've really settled to give away half your little inheritance?
No, I haven't settled anything.
But you mean practically to let Marion collar it?
Is it your idea that I should give it to you?
Far from it.
If I were to sign my aunt's agreement, I would carry it out to the letter.
Of course. The only way to play the game is to play it. There's no limit to what your aunt can do for you.
You mean in the way of marrying me?
Marry properly.
And then?
And then? Well, we will talk.
Goodbye, Papa. It may be for a long time.
Why not call it forever?